fairly tight schedule. There's a committee moving in right after us here. So we'll be keeping track of that time, making sure everybody gets the allotted time to share their story. We would ask that you just hold your questions to the end. It's not basically all these bills will be held over for possible inclusion in the bill. And so if there isn't time for the questions that you may have, we would just encourage you to organize your own meetings with these organizations to get additional information. The first item we have on the agenda here is the University of Minnesota, and the committee would like to welcome President Eric Kaler.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. I am Eric Kaler, the 16th president of the University of Minnesota. I'm joined here today by Richard Fissenruder, the university's chief financial officer, and Kathleen O'Brien, vice president for university services. They will amplify and on occasion, I'm sure, correct the comments that I have for you this morning. I appreciate very much the opportunity to share with you our 2012 capital request. I want you to know, and I think many of you do, that I am committed to leading a responsive and transparent administration. Please do not hesitate to contact me or a member of our administrative team should you have questions or need more information about the university. Please let me begin with the mission of the University of Minnesota. With our more than 69,000 students, our 25,000 employees, our five campuses, and our extension, which reaches all 87 counties. Our mission is carried out on five campuses: Crookston, Duluth, Morris, Rochester, and the Twin Cities, 14 regional extension offices, 11 research and outreach centers throughout the state. Through our extension and outreach, cultural, athletic, clinical, and youth development programs, we directly impact the lives of millions of Minnesotans annually. The U is unique among Minnesota's more than 30 public and its two dozen or so private, nonprofit, and for-profit institutions. We are the state's only public land-grant research institution. And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I hope you saw this outstanding article on the front page of the Star Tribune on Sunday about the groundbreaking research on Alzheimer's disease that our Regents Professor Karen Ash is conducting. I would urge you to read that story to understand some of the power and promise of our research university. Last fall, we enrolled 44,000 undergraduates and 18,000 graduate and professional students on our campuses, with another 7,000 non-degree students for good measure. We award about 14,000 degrees annually, delivering to the state some of the best qualified, critically thoughtful, highly skilled, and curious talent in the nation. These degrees include 90% of Minnesota's science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM, doctoral degrees, 85% of all degrees granted in Minnesota to physicians, and 100% of all dental, pharmacy, and veterinary degrees granted in the state. As you can see, the quality of our incoming freshman class was also our best ever. We are attracting and graduating many of the state's best and brightest students. That excellence and rigor enhances the value of a University of Minnesota degree. But your university is about much more than just workforce development. Our researchers attract $800 million in funding to our state each year. That puts us eighth in the nation among public institutions for research funding. That's remarkable considering we are 21st in the nation in state population. We do indeed fight above our weight. Our research mission attracts some of the world's great scientists and investigators. We have a history of developing cures, medical devices, the car seat belt, and new strains of apples and wheat. Currently, we are a center for research into safety for the world's food supply, cures for diabetes and Alzheimer's, and for new nanotechnology processes that could aid Minnesota's manufacturing sector. Research funding, mostly from federal research organizations such as the National Institutes of Health or the National Science Foundation, support about 16,000 jobs annually in Minnesota. Research funding teaches young scientists, our students, how to be great scientists. Our partnership with the state of Minnesota is critical to the health and vitality of this great institution, our University of Minnesota. We provide an exceptional return on investment. For every dollar you here at the legislature and the governor invest in the U, we return $13.20 to the state economy. That's a 13-to-1 return on investment on every dollar. The university significantly impacts the statewide economy through expenditures, government revenues, and employment and personal income of residents. Beyond these financial benefits, the U is preparing the workforce of the future and creating a stronger Minnesota. And I would like to add We are extremely thankful for all that the legislature has provided to the university over the years. We are confident we have stewarded your investment wisely. I want to particularly mention that your most recent bonding decisions helped construct our innovative and student-focused science teaching and student services building. Also this past summer, we were pleased to receive $83 million for physics and nanotechnology, and that project is already significantly underway. Those dollars are not earning interest in an account somewhere. They are being spent today to put Minnesotans to work and purchase Minnesota-made products from Minnesota suppliers. Your support of the Biomedical Discovery District is nothing short of a game changer. It is in these state-of-art laboratories that Minnesota will lead the way in finding cures to diseases that afflict us all. Our capital request that I will present to you this morning emerges from a diligently thought-out six-year capital plan. That plan, approved by our Board of Regents, prioritizes projects with consideration of strategic academic priorities, facility condition assessments, campus master plans, and our financial and debt capacity. Now let me take a very few minutes, to walk you through the specifics of each project in this year's request. Overall, we have advanced a historically modest $169 million request, and it includes five key projects. First, our higher education asset preservation and resource funding, and restoration funding, HEPR for short. The University of Minnesota is home to more than 850 buildings with more than 28 million square feet of space statewide. Compared to all other public entities, the University of Minnesota's facility inventory includes the oldest buildings. 70% of the buildings are more than 30 years old. More significantly, about a quarter of our buildings are at least 70 years old. Again, a quarter of our buildings are at least 70 years old. To fulfill our academic mission and graduate students who are ready to work in today's high-technology business research and production environments, our facilities must be at the cutting edge. We cannot train tomorrow's generation of workers in yesterday's laboratories or classrooms. To extend the useful life of our infrastructure, we request $90 million for HEPR. This request will support 75 projects on all five campuses around the state and throughout our research and field stations. HEPR projects are prioritized. They are prioritized to improve safety and accessibility, to extend facility life, and to improve energy efficiency. In this way, our HEPR request is about much more than bricks or mortar. These investments are critical to strategically reducing operating costs, leveraging external research funding, and most importantly, enhancing student success. And as my wife told me, quite poetically, strategically speaking for the state, HEPR is cheaper. She did say that. Second, let me turn to the combined heat and power plant project. This is critical to the heating and energy needs of the university's Twin Cities campus, especially as it affects our academic health center and research efforts. Currently, the Minnesota campus relies on the Southeast Steam Plant for 100% of its steam. In recent years, we had catastrophic events frighteningly close to the Southeast Steam Plant, including the tragic I-35 bridge collapse and a train derailment. Had those events knocked out our one major pipe leading from the Southeast Steam Plant to the rest of campus, there would literally have been a blackout of heat on the Minneapolis campus, threatening hundreds of millions of dollars in research and patient and health services in our medical center. Today, the University's of Minneapolis campus includes about 18 million square feet through 163 buildings with growing heating, cooling, and electrical needs. The university anticipates a shortage of boiler capacity for the Minneapolis campus beginning in 2015 due to increasing demand and aging equipment. The old main plant, which this will replace, is currently decommissioned and is the ideal location for a second source of steam production. We propose adding 2 7-megawatt natural gas-fired turbines as a combined heat and power system with heat recovery steam generators. They would replace inefficient World War II-era coal burners. We would construct systems also to support a future chilled water cluster plant and an additional natural gas boiler. Next up is our Itasca Biological Station and Laboratories, which, like no other location in our state, lives at the convergence of three ecosystems, our pine forest, hardwood forest, and tallgrass prairie. Affiliated with our College of Biological Sciences in the Twin Cities, which attracts the state's most qualified young scientists. The station has brought tens of thousands of students, teachers, and scientists to this place near the headwaters of the Mississippi River and about 30 miles from Bemidji. As modern as the science is that is being explored there, the facilities are World War II era. This project will consolidate functions from three deteriorating facilities into a new campus center, a 12,000-square-foot year-round facility with laboratories, classrooms, offices, and an auditorium, all well-equipped with the latest technology. This project will create 12 full-time, year-round jobs and be a living laboratory for 130 students and faculty. The Itasca Field Station and laboratories are essential to the university's research mission, as the most sophisticated molecular biological laboratory is. It will respond to increasing demand from increased enrollment in our College of Biological Sciences and continue our keen interest in preserving Minnesota's fragile environment. The next project, the Eddy Hall renovation, is actually in several parts. First is Eddy Hall itself. Built in 1886, Eddy Hall is the oldest building on the University of Minnesota's Twin Cities campus and is on the National Registry of Historic Places. The building is now vacant and no longer functional. This capital request is twofold. First, we will rehabilitate Eddy Hall for international and transfer student admissions programs. This will improve accessibility for students and will create approximately 20,000 square feet of office and student service space, adding fire safety features and provide major structural repairs. This building will serve approximately 4,000 students. In 2011, we had 2,000 new transfer students and 2,300 international graduate students. The new transfer students come primarily from Minscu campuses. The second phase of the project is to reconfigure three buildings to strategically provide approximately 100,000 square feet of alternative workspace. Occupants of Williamson and Fraser Halls will be relocated into three new buildings, and the outdated Williamson and Fraser Halls will be decommissioned, saving approximately $1.1 million a year in operating costs. The alternative workplace strategy that we will use is a growing trend in the private sector, and it will remedy space constraints while reducing cost and improving performance. This is a way of working modeled already in Minnesota companies, and we have learned from a General Mills pilot study that we will mimic, and those General Mills employees tell researchers that they would not return to a traditional workspace. I understand the state of Minnesota is exploring similar ideas. Finally, let me turn to the American Indian Learning Resource Center on our Duluth campus, a project previously passed by the legislature but vetoed by Governor Pawlenty in 2010. We want to construct a new four-story facility to consolidate American Indian Studies programs into one building prominently located on the southwest corner of campus. We would construct classrooms, a library, a computer lab, and space for faculty and student services while housing precious Native artifacts. It will consolidate more than 20 American Indian programs on campus. This new facility will stand as a gateway to the UMD campus and serve many non-Native students as well. In fact, the majority of students taking American Indian-related classes at UMD are non-Native, even as UMD is noted for the size of its American Indian student community and the number of American Indian physicians who are trained at our medical school there. I visited Duluth earlier this month, and I'm pleased to report there is deep and broad support for this project within the Duluth and northeastern Minnesota business community. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it is important that you know that each of the five projects I have presented to you today will help us fulfill our mission of delivering the best possible academic experience for our students, of increasing our ability to retain and attract top researchers and their grants, and generating statewide economic returns, including job creation. The University of Minnesota is mindful of the budgetary pressures you and your colleagues face, but there is no greater investment than the University of Minnesota. And we, of course, are committed to investing $40 million of our own bonding capacity to partner with the state on these projects. For us to attract and retain the best students, faculty, and staff, our physical plant must be responsibly and environmentally state-of-the-art. For us to train our students in the most productive surroundings, we need excellent facilities. Mr. Chair, members, I'm honored to be here today to represent your state's only research university. You may know I came back to the U because I believe in the institution, its students, and its mission. In the past, you have partnered with the university to provide the resources that are needed to maximize its potential, and I hope you will do the same this year. We respectfully seek your support for our capital request. Mr. Chair, that concludes my presentation. I would be pleased to stand for questions.
Thank you, President Kaler. At this point, we have three more testifiers that we need to get in before 9 o'clock, and so I think I would just ask members to hold their questions at this point. And if we get up against our deadline for the University of Minnesota, I would just encourage each of your offices to contact President Kaler's staff directly, and I'm sure they'll get your questions answered. President, according to my list here, we have three more folks that want to testify representing the University of Minnesota. Is that
true.
Correct?
That is okay. True. Thank you, sir.
All right. We'll move on. Just asking each of the next representatives to take about 3 minutes or so. We have Chris Tasted. Mr. Tasted, welcome to the committee.
Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for having me. My name is Christopher Tasted. I'm a student at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus studying biochemistry, and I'm the Minnesota Student Legislative Coalition chairman representing the student voice in the legislative process. I'd like to speak today on behalf of the Bonnie Project, showing support on behalf of students for the project and for the platform as a whole. President Kaler represented the operational capacity of the university and the value of these projects in terms of the master plan, and what I'd like to do is touch very briefly on the context that I can provide from a student perspective and ultimately give you the story from one of these particular projects, that being the Itasca Biological Station, in the hopes of representing what is really going on with these facilities beyond looking at the value from an operational standpoint. So I'd like to touch on the Itasca Biological Station specifically due to the fact that it holds a special place in my heart as a biology student, essentially because that's where I began my college career. And along with every other incoming student in the College of Biological Sciences, we are able to participate in a program called the Nature of Life. This is a program that every incoming freshman on the Twin Cities campus participates in, and it's an opportunity to go to Itasca, interact with faculty, and for 3 days conduct research at the facility and really gain a true appreciation for what Itasca is, what it means to the state, and how that fits in with the university's mission. In this program, we have an opportunity to work with our faculty. It's actually where I first met Dean Eldy. He was there for all 3 days of the camp. And they're in their shorts, they're outside of their research, and they're really participating with students and engaging them. It builds a strong sense of community, and it builds a strong sense of the way that people can begin what they want to do in terms of fulfilling their goals at the university and fulfilling the university's mission as a whole in terms of their science and research focus. Other factors that are stressed and really encouraged in this is engaging the research process and effectively learning biology in an integrative way, in a meaningful way. So not exactly just teaching biology. Our faculty really focus on training biologists. So it's the idea that a program like this is serving as the initiation, as the starting point for what our students that are going to go on to be the leaders in biotechnology and in healthcare and the like in the state of Minnesota. This is really where they're getting their start. And facilities like the Itasca Biological Station serve best to start this process and really serve as a foundation for those things. So I would encourage you, as this is a representative case where our platform can move the university's initiatives, move forward that mission as a whole, to support this platform as a whole, and I would be happy to stand for questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Tasted. As I mentioned earlier, we'll just encourage each individual member to contact you directly if they have questions about your testimony at this point. Next, we have Dr. Carolyn Hayes.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm honored to be here today. I'm Caroline Hayes, Professor of Mechanical Engineering at the University of Minnesota. And the main message I have for you today is that the aging infrastructure of the University of Minnesota has become an impediment to our ability to give students a 21st century education. So my colleague, David Bennett, and I will provide you with a few examples drawn from engineering, which I think illustrate this, but are also representative not just of our department, but of departments across the university and across all campuses. So a professor in our department, Davidson, has developed a solar simulator which draws 45,000 watts. And it reaches temperatures of 36,000 degrees at the focal point. So Davidson actually keeps sunblock in her lab to prevent the students from getting sunburned. No joke. The solar simulator enables the students, the faculty, and local entrepreneurs who are inventing new solar technologies to test these emerging technologies, which then can be turned into products which fuel our economy. However, when you look at our old building, you cannot expect to plug in a 45,000-watt device into the outlet of a 1948 building and expect not to blow the fuse. So we had to house it elsewhere. But in summary, the type of education we provide at the University of Minnesota, these types of facilities are integral to that education, because what we're doing is we're teaching students to be inventors who can create the future technologies. And this is what sets research universities apart, and this is what makes them so valuable to companies and to the economy of Minnesota. Students get this type of education, being inventors, not just by reading textbooks and being lectured by us, although that's an important part of it. They need these laboratory facilities so that they can build their own devices that they've invented and test them, fail, and then sometimes succeed. Both of those are important in that process. So with me here today is Mr. David Bennett, who will present another example of how our aging infrastructure is an impediment to education. He is notable because he's both an entrepreneur and a current graduate student in our mechanical engineering department. Early in his career, he founded a company, a Minnesota engine company called Biphase Technologies, which he sold in 2000. But he was not content to rest on his laurels and play golf. He returned to graduate school in 2009 because he wants to keep on learning and keep on inventing. Thank you, Mr. Bennett.
Thank you, Dr. Hayes. Mr. Bennett, just 3 minutes, please. We did have one additional testifier get added to the list here for the University of Minnesota. So if we could just ask you to keep it to about 3 minutes, we'd be grateful. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm David Bennett, the oldest full-time graduate student in mechanical engineering. I'm here to give you an example of our current infrastructure that is an impediment to 21st century education. I returned to graduate school in 2009 to gain theoretical know-how to design a fuel system that was unavailable to me previously, to utilize the newly discovered supplies of natural gas in this country in the upcoming generation of American truck engines starting in 2014. We are the only American university working on such a project. It is, however, being pursued in South Korea, Japan, Australia, and China. Already, 7 patent disclosures have been filed with the university's Office of Technology Commercialization. However, I can't even test a portion of this new system in the current 1948 building because the laboratory ventilation is not up to modern code. Furthermore, it is not possible to update one lab at a time because code requires that when we make one change, we must bring the whole building up to code. HEPR funds will make it possible to bring the lab up to 21st century standards so that new technologies can continue to be explored. And important to me, young engineering students can be educated with hands-on experience in emerging technologies. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. Next, we have Mr. Hartley. Mr. Hartley, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to address the need for an American Indian Learning Resource Center. My name is Michael Hartley. from Rosemount, Minnesota, and I am an American Indian Studies major at UMD. I'm here with four colleagues, Mary Anderson from Boys Fort, Ashley Compton from Chicago, Sundown Lettergrass from Turtle Mountains, North Dakota, and Tish Baptiste from, I might say this wrong, but Natchitoches, New Mexico. I'd like to address 2 points today. Why the American Indian Learning Resource Center is inclusive and welcoming to all, how it enhances diversity, and its importance to help students succeed. As a non-Indian, I came into the American Indian Learning Resource Center, the current location, 2 years ago, was welcomed by everyone there, including our director, Rick, who is now a mentor. I was given an opportunity to work there, and to address how it's inclusive and welcoming. Every time you come in there, no matter who you are, the first thing you're asked is your name, where you're from, and how you can be helped. We provide services such as free printing, free coffee, free food once a month. It's a very warming, welcoming place for all students. One thing I would like to put an emphasis on is the fact that it just doesn't serve American Indian students or American Indian people. That's been a point of concern for a lot of different people involved in this, and I just want to make sure that it's known that we serve many more people than just American Indian people. It helps to improve the diversity on the campus because you're literally bringing people from tons of different backgrounds, different cultures, into one place where it's safe to talk about the differences and the similarities in between those cultures. And lastly, it's important to help students succeed. We have the second largest collection of American Indian-related books and resources called the Meshomas Collection. It's a huge resource. Between the three people who work in that office, it's an amazing amount of resources for anyone who's interested in studying the history of Minnesota and another culture. I'll conclude with that and open
great
for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hartley and President Kaler. We're grateful for all the staff and representatives you brought to talk about the University of Minnesota this morning. My hope is you haven't felt rushed. It's just an imperative we make way for the next committee and be respectful of the schedule that's been given to us this morning. So we appreciate you coming in.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for your time. We understand your schedule.
All right.
We'll respond to questions you might have offline. Thank
great
you.
Thank you. Next, we have the Minnesota Library Association and Ms. Elaine Keith. And looks like you're being joined by Mr. Bob Boise. Is that right?
Bays. Thank you.
Bays, sorry. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Senator Rosen.
While everybody's getting ready, I was just wondering if sometimes it would be helpful to have a list and documentation of what has been funded for the U and all these other projects in the past. Perhaps where they're at, like the science and nanotechnology building that we funded last year. It would be nice to know where it's at, when date of completion, for how much money, just to see if we're meeting the benchmarks and moving
sure
forward.
Sure. Yes, thank you, Senator Rosen. So you'd like, moving forward, you'd like to see a list of projects that have been funded within that organization in the past and the current status?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. We'll make a note of that here with our committee administrator and have that for you in subsequent hearings. Thank you. Ms. Elaine Keefe, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Elaine Keefe. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Library Association to talk to you today about public library accessibility and improvement grants. And this grant program was originally established in 1994 to provide matching grants to public libraries so they could make their buildings handicap accessible. However, after a few years, what we found was that the libraries that only needed relatively modest renovations had been taken care of, and that we kind of reached the limits of what we could do with this grant program with accessibility alone. And so the remaining buildings really needed major renovations or, in some cases, outright replacement. And it didn't make sense to spend money to install elevators or ramps or handicap accessible bathrooms in those buildings. And so in 2005, the legislature broadened the program to include grants for construction of new libraries and renovation of existing libraries. And Senator Rosen and I apparently think alike, because in your packets, we have provided a list of all the grants that have been made under this program since its inception in 1994. So you have that. On the first page are the construction grants, which have been made since the program was broadened in 2005. There are 10 libraries that have received funding so far. And then on the remaining pages, which are back-to-back because that's a longer document, you can see that there are 101 libraries throughout the state that have received accessibility grants since 1994. You can also see that although the required match is 1-to-1, in reality, the ratio of local funding to state funding has been much higher. So we've done a great job of leveraging local funds, and I think there's been a great return on investment for the state. For the accessibility grants, it's been almost $7 of local funding that's been generated for every dollar of state funding. And for the construction grants, it's been almost $9 of local funding for every dollar of state funding. So there really is a very substantial local effort that takes place. And while the bulk of the local funds come from cities and counties, we often see in communities that volunteers work to raise funds for their library. They hold bake sales, they hold teas, they sell used book sales, they solicit funds from local donors. And I know of at least one community where they actually had children who went out and collected pennies to help support their new library building. So people really do love their libraries, but they often need some help from the state in order to raise what they need to keep their buildings current. Despite the success of this program, there are still significant number of public library buildings in the state that are badly in need of either major renovation or outright replacement. The State Library Services Office estimates that about a third of the libraries in the state are still not handicapped accessible. We have a lot of older library buildings in our state. About 52% of our public library buildings were built in the 1970s or earlier, and 25% were actually built in the 1940s or earlier. And as you might imagine, library service has changed significantly since these libraries were built. Many of these older buildings don't have adequate space for public access to computers, children's programs, young adult study and research, or to accommodate new technology. So the need to upgrade our libraries is statewide, and our survey indicates that we can expect about $68 million worth of library projects to be applying for whatever amount is provided in this year's bonding bill. You have a list of likely applicants in your packet. I see a number of you looking at it. It's the blue sheet. This is based on our survey. It's informational only. So, you know, some of these folks may end up not applying if they have trouble with their local match. Somebody else may come forward that we aren't aware of. But this is the best information that we have at this time. I think the point is there's plenty of demand throughout the state for these grants. In the past, a few individual communities have received funding directly from the legislature in the bonding bill, either to build new libraries or to renovate existing libraries. And if you look back 10 years or so ago, you would see probably a dozen bills introduced in each legislative session to fund individual library projects. And we hope that by going with this approach, we've spared you from hearing from all of them. Rather than having those individual communities come to the legislature, we believe that this competitive grant program is the fairest and most efficient way to sort through these requests. And this is administered by the Library Office at the Department of Education, and they go through a competitive grant application process. We've succeeded in convincing libraries that this is the way to go, and so you aren't seeing those individual bills come forward anymore. In closing, I want to emphasize that libraries are not just a local resource. A library card from your local public library enables you to borrow materials from almost any public library in the state, and that's a real benefit to our citizens. We all do work together. Public libraries typically serve residents from well beyond the borders of the cities and counties that provide the bulk of the funding for those libraries. And that's why we think it makes sense for the state to partner with our local communities in order to make sure that we have modern library facilities that can meet the information and education needs of Minnesotans. And I have with me Bob Bays, who is the Minnesota Library Association Legislative Chair, who can help to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. O'Keefe. Any questions, members? They're ahead of schedule, so.
Do we get brownie points for that, Mr. Chair?
Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Keefe. Are there any incentives that we might also look at for the co-location of other libraries that might be public school libraries?
Mr. Chair, I have with me the statute that governs these grants and the criteria that are laid out that the Department of Education is to look at when they look at the grant applications, and the degree of collaboration with other public or private agencies is one of those factors. So it is considered in these grant applications.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Keefe, do you know how many libraries do have a co-location with the public school and community library in general? And I put that in the context that most schools look at themselves now as lifelong learning centers, open to the community. They encourage that. We know there's a focus, but it's beyond that with community ed. And with that, I'm hopeful that we can have more co-location or consolidation.
Mr. O'Keefe.
So how much is going on?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wieger, there are lots of joint use facilities around the state that involve public libraries, but the most common arrangement is with other municipal services, so a joint library and city hall building, or you may be familiar with some of the metro area libraries are in with county service centers where people go and get their driver's license renewed and that sort of thing. That is the more common arrangement. There are two joint school public libraries in the state. One is in Pipestone, one is in Comfrey. Those tend to be, frankly, more difficult partnerships, and I think it's because you have a school board or a school superintendent and a city council or a mayor, and sometimes it's hard for them to work out the governance in terms of who's got control of the budget, the hiring, and that sort of thing. So it can work, but it has been tried in many places and has not worked out. There is also a joint public library at Metropolitan State in St. Paul. So that's another co-location that we have out there. But, there have been, frankly, some difficulties with that. I will say also that safety often comes into play because a public library needs to be open to the public all the time. And, of course, many schools tightly control access in order to ensure student safety. So it is a local decision, ultimately. But as I said, that is one of the factors that is taken into consideration in awarding these grants.
Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wieger and others, this collaboration situation, for example, in Invergrove Heights, Minnesota, one of the towns I represent, about 15 years ago, the city was contemplating building a library. The county was thinking about building the library in Invergrove, and a community college. Well, they all got together, worked it out, and they built one library instead of three, saving the taxpayers a lot of money, and it's right in the campus of all of the city hall. So it can work, and it does work. And we should encourage more and more of this for many reasons. Saving money is one, a good one, and other reasons. So let's keep looking at that collaboration stuff going forward. Maybe you could group a couple of these libraries in one facility instead of one, blah, blah, blah. So
thank you, Senator Metzen.
It can work, and it does work.
Thank you, Senator Metzen. Mr. Bays.
Mr. Chair, Senators, it can work out, especially when the needs and desires of all the different parties are taken into consideration. And that quite often is most easily done when the happy confluence of new construction for several different entities happens. When you try and retrofit something, it's more difficult addressing the needs of everyone. There have been instances also in the state of Minnesota where schools have contracted with public library services in their school buildings. Most of those have been discontinued for one reason or another, generally because the schools have needs that differ from the public libraries.
Thank you, Mr. Bass. Seeing no other questions, thank you for your presentation this morning. Next, we would have the Minnesota State Academies, Ms. Linda Mitchell and Mr. Randy Dirks. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Mitchell.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. I am Linda Mitchell. I am the superintendent of the State Academies down in Faribault, Minnesota. The Minnesota State Academies are an independent state agency made up of two schools, the Minnesota State Academy for the Blind and the Minnesota State Academy for the Deaf. I don't know how much you want to hear about who we are and what we do, or if you want me to jump into our bonding requests.
Ms. Mitchell, we have about 15 minutes scheduled, so I think if it might be appropriate to jump into the bonding requests, and certainly we'll continue to encourage members to contact you directly if they have additional questions, if we happen to be short on time.
Okay. And with that, we handed out pamphlets that I would like to explain a little bit to you. We did include on the left side of your pamphlet, we have our budget narrative and the governor's budget recommendations for us. We will talk about all of our requests as we go through this. I want to, first of all, thank you for the funding that you gave us last time. We appreciate the money for asset preservation. I would direct your attention to page 6 in the governor's budget recommendations, which does give you a history of asset preservation funding from the last several years so that you get an idea. We don't seem to run out of roofs and windows and sidewalks to repair. So a good portion of our asset preservation goes to those kinds of things. We also appreciate the funding that you gave us for what we call the A-plus house. This was a unique collaborative between South Central College in Faribault and our State Academy for the Blind. This was a house that was constructed by the carpentry class at South Central and is on our blind school campus and serves what we call our non-traditional students who are 18 to 21 years old who have unsigned diplomas. While they may have completed their high school coursework, they're still on an IEP, so we can serve them until they're 21 years old. These are students who are working on a couple of things. One is the independent living needs that they may have in terms of learning how to navigate the world, orientation and mobility, how to take care of their laundry, how to cook, how to literally be independent. And they either are taking classes at South Central or they may be employed in our community in a job. And this is really their last stop before they leave and hopefully are going to be able to be independent and on their own. We currently have 7 young ladies living in this house, and it has been a very successful year. We've seen great growth and are feeling confident, that this is going to be very supportive to them. Once they're 21, State Services for the Blind can pick them up and work with them some more. But what we were seeing before was that while they were under 21, if they leave at 18, they run out of time that State Services for the Blind can work with them, and they still need some support. So between South Central and State Services for the Blind, we see this as a very successful collaborative. And last but not least, and there's some history here, we appreciate the pre-design money. We do have pre-design ready now for a technology center. I have to give you a little bit of history here because we've been asking to replace Mott Hall on the Deaf School campus for, I think, since 1997-98. And it is an old vocational building. It no longer serves a purpose for education. We would like to be able to act. The structure is solid, I will say that. We would like to be able to turn it over to our physical plant director who needs more space for the basic physical operation of the two campuses. But having said that, when we initially came to the legislature years ago, we asked for funding to redesign Mott Hall. And in the process of getting architects involved, they said, no, that it's not going to work. We did not at that time spend the $100,000 for Mott Hall, but came back to you 2 years later and requested a change in the language. So we appreciate that changing that to a technology center pre-design. The design that we now have ready for you is an addition to Smith Hall, which is on the MSAD Deaf School campus. This design will serve both populations. It is a building that is constructed with what we would call multi-purpose spaces. There is a large computer classroom and a small computer classroom. For want of a better term, I would say a fab lab concept. And we believe that this is the piece that will help our students be competitive in this 21st century. One of the things that has changed, and it's been a plus for us, has been that we have deaf students who are visual learners. We have blind students who are auditory learners. The big challenge for us has always been their access to information. Technology has leveled the playing field for that purpose so that our students are now able to do many, many more things and compete in the job market in many more ways. We have students who are going to technical colleges. We currently have a graduate who is working at Sage in Faribault. That is the company that makes the glass that turns dark as the light comes through, the chemical part of that. And we're seeing a good connection for our students to be able to work in manufacturing. Having said that, we ask staff from both campuses to be a part of this design, so this building is accessible to both populations. And as you can imagine, in a regular high school, you have bells that change classes or music or something in the hallway, which is what happens on the blind school campus. On the deaf school campus, we have flashing lights. So all of those details have been addressed to meet both populations' needs within this one, this one space. On your in your packet on the right side, I wanted to share with you the location. The first page is a map of the Deaf School campus. The Technology Center, which is really our big request, it is the one thing that we would like to see happen, is the red space at the bottom of this map. That is the entrance to the Deaf School and where the building would be located. This request is a $6.15 million request and is probably the most important in terms of priorities that we have before you. We do also have a demolition for Frechette Hall, which for those of you who have visited our campus over the years, this is an old dorm. It was built, actually, in the 60s, late 60s, early 70s. It's poorly constructed. It is not energy efficient. It is not, it has very low ceilings and hallways. Plexiglass connects three pods that are a part of the main building, and I believe in the winter we have as much snow and ice that come in under the doors and the hallways as ever, but maybe that's the good news this year without much snow. We now have renovated the bathrooms in Pollard Hall so that we have a plan in place to house our boys during a transition time. If we knock down Frechette Hall, we would have a place for the boys to live until a new dorm was constructed. The other part of the demolition is an old laundry building. As you look at this map, number 3, there is an arrow that points to Frechette Hall and also to the laundry building. The laundry building is one of the, it's actually the only remaining building from the original campus. It is not worth anything. It is small. I think we put a new roof on it about 15 years ago, but it really needs to come down. Just for safety purposes, it has no use. At one point, I will say the deaf community would like to have made it a deaf cultural center. However, in order to make that building even usable, I think Randy said it probably cost us $2 million, and it would not be worth it. So it does need to come down. That is the demolition money. The parking lot, and I have to give you a little history here too, is the number 4 on the front of your map. And the Lauritsen Gymnasium, which is the place where there's a lot of activity, was built back in the 1930s. And at that time, of course, there weren't lots of automobiles. And as you look at our campus map, we don't have parking. And the gym was not built as a spectator gym. It was built for students who attended the academy to have a place to have recreation. So now we have a problem with no place to park when fans come to basketball games, volleyball games, and all the other activities that go on. It isn't, however, just a matter of needing parking spaces. As we talk about Olaf Hansen Drive, and as you look at that circle that goes around, our students play in the middle of that field. There's a softball field. It is to them playing area. And so this campus place that is their home, they don't really, and I don't want to say that they're careless, but they are also deaf and they are children, and we have kids from 3 years old to 21. So our problem is that they go back and forth across this road after school and in the evenings when they're playing outside. And we have parallel parking there. Well, the kids run out between the cars, and quite frankly, they don't pay attention. We like to get the traffic out of this circle. Right now, there is a road that goes on Shumway into Shattuck, and we would be able to use that road because, frankly, it's our land. And come into a parking lot where number 4 is there without going inside the circle. So not only would we have a place for parking, but we would also eliminate a good deal of traffic inside that circle, which for us is a safety concern. Last but not least on our list is the $500 request for an A-plus house on the deaf school campus. We would put that house up in the far, northeast corner, where there is plenty of room, and it's a little bit more separated from the rest of the campus. We would like that to be the case for these kids who are 18 to 21 and separate them a little bit from our K-12 dormitories on the campus. This building would serve the same purpose, same kind of purpose, as the A-plus house on the MSAB campus for students who are deaf.
Thank you, Ms. Mitchell.
Questions?
We have about 5 minutes left with with the time we had allotted for your presentation. Members have any questions at all?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator?
Ms. Mitchell? How many participants do you have total in your schools? How many students do you have?
We have had a stable population for the 15 years that I have been coming up here. That while I know across the nation there has been a decline in some of the schools for the deaf particularly, our population has maintained that 150 at the deaf school, between 50 and 60 at the blind school for as long as I have been there. Now, those are students that are enrolled, and I should say we probably serve 500-plus students in an annual year because we have summer programs in the summer. And we also have outreach where our staff go to school districts and serve kids in the mainstream. This is particularly true for orientation and mobility for kids who are blind and providing services for teachers of the deaf and teachers of the blind, which I do have to say, I think that's one of the reasons that we continue to have a population that is now slowly creeping up. And I'll add a little caveat here, too, because we passed some language last year that I think is affecting that. But part of the problem is that there are no training programs for teachers of the blind, visually impaired in the state, and not just in the state, I can tell you around the country. Our staff are going to Colorado, they go to Pennsylvania, and part of the problem has been those programs are full and you can't get in. So that's an issue. And for the small rural school districts, it's very difficult to find those specialized staff to work with the students, and so they're coming to us. The other piece of that is statute language that you passed last year, which is what we call our trial placement language. But up until last year, the school districts really were the gatekeepers for students to attend the academies. And while a parent could request that their child come unless the school district agreed, that was not possible. We now have language that says with a parent's request, and if the child meets criteria for deafness or blindness, they can come to the academies for a 90-day trial placement. And then if everybody agrees it's an appropriate place, then they can stay. So we have a number of students who are now attending under that language.
Okay. Thanks, Ms. Mitchell. We had one more question, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Mitchell, when you mentioned coming off of Shumway Avenue, whereabouts on that?
It's the one thing, and I have to confess, we borrowed this from our architects. So actually, right about the place where the number 4 is off of Shumway, it comes off and it curves up to the north. For those of you who have been to Faribault, we own the land that Shattuck uses to go through their archway into their campus. So we have given them that kind of easement to get in and out of there for as long as I can remember.
Okay. So Mr. Chairman, you just Ms. Mitchell, you build a new road just to cross over and connect it?
We would use the current road, and there's probably about 10 yards where you would go off of that road to the parking lot where number 4 is, and then, you know, the rest of the road would go on into Shattuck like it currently does. And it's not drawn on here.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mitchell. Next, we have the Purpich. We appreciate you coming. Thank you for your presentation of your project. Next, we have the Purpich School for the Arts. We have Ms. Paulson and Mr. Zabel. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Pam Paulson, and I serve as the Senior Director of Policy at the Purpich Center for Arts Education. And with me is Mike Zabel, who's the Director of Administrative Management, and that includes finance in case you have some questions that directly relate to the budget. First of all, thank you for having us here today to hear our presentation about the bonding requests. And second, we are so appreciative of the support that you have given us in the past for improvements and repairs of the campus. We are very pleased to be included in the governor's budget, but as you might expect, there are additional needs. And we want to preserve our campus assets and develop our necessary infrastructure and ensure safety on a campus that houses a residential state high school as well as professional development for teachers. And we have found that there's a significant need for the Purpich Center. This last year, the Department of Education did a staff development survey that indicated that 85% of the school districts in our state would like to have the services of the Purpich Center for things like curriculum development, for understanding the state academic standards in the arts, K-12, and for developing systems of accountability and assessment for student learning, since there is no standardized test for the arts. We are helping school districts develop performance assessments and understanding how to measure student learning in different ways. As you know, Senator Latz has introduced a bill for the bondings, Senate File 1827, to expand on the requests that were in the original bonding request. And we appreciate his leadership for bringing this forward. He knows firsthand about the information technology needs at the Purpich Center. And we are also grateful for the bipartisan support that we have received over the years. We would like to make sure that our campus is as efficient and effective as possible in reaching students and teachers statewide through digital connections. And that is an area that we really need to work on to meet our mission of increasing student learning and teacher learning. So there are four projects in your packet. If you look on the right-hand side, there's a one-page sheet that identifies these four projects. Three of them are given more detail in the agency overview and the capital investment request. But the fourth project, which has to do with information technology, is new. And it seems that there is some room for interpretation about what qualifies for technology bonding. So these items really demonstrate the need, that the serious need that the Purpich Center has for IT infrastructure. So the first project is the $100,000 for design and installation of storm drainage. We happen to be the lowest point in the Bassett Watershed Creek district, and therefore all the water runs onto our campus, and it does a lot of good and damage, and we need to funnel that with some curbing and some intentional direction of the water into the areas that we would like it to go, so that it quits wearing away things like our driveways, our building foundation, and our loading dock. The second thing is the road repair. And there's an additional $70,000 on that request because the sign that indicates that we are the Purpich Center for Arts Education out by the Highway 55 was run over and demolished by some kind of a large vehicle this early winter, and that needs to be replaced. The third one is $64,000 to complete the design and repair of the loading dock and the steps. Some of you were out there a little while ago, a year or two ago, to look at that, and you could see that it's deteriorating because of age and the fact that we have the water runoff. And then the fourth one is the technology proposal. And it's important for us to bring this to you because as a state agency, we are not able to levy any money for additional technology or any operating costs. So we cannot levy for any additional dollars, nor as a state agency are we eligible for the kinds of technology funds that flow through the Department of Education, because those go to school districts and we're not considered a school district. So we're kind of in the middle between those two things and not having funding sources in either direction. And frankly, we are charged with being innovative and cutting edge and have slipped in that area because of our technology infrastructure and our ability to serve as a statewide resource. Now, actually, other school districts who have had an infusion of technology dollars are ahead of us, and we need to catch up and lead again so that we can be most helpful to the teachers and school administrators who are working all across the state to improve education for our students. We're looking forward to the consolidation with OET to create greater efficiencies, to attend to technology infrastructure improvements in a more timely fashion. Carolyn Parnell, who's the CIO of OET, visited the Purpich Center last week and is aware of this request. And we feel like it focuses on your legislative goal of delivering more services electronically. But in order to do this, we need to do some remodeling, like the mechanical room in the administrative building, which was an office, needs to be remodeled so that it actually is an appropriate climate control and space for the agency's IT infrastructure. We need to remodel another room in another building to create a backup system for this the servers and this technology system so that we are not suffering from these disruptions of service caused by inadequate facilities and improperly stored equipment. and we need to upgrade our what's called building automation system that controls everything from heating and cooling and lighting. And even the key card system, that needs to be upgraded. And finally, we have some security issues, especially running a residential school where we need some cameras and we need some infrastructure to make sure that security is in place. So that is an overview of some of our needs and our requests. We really appreciate your expertise, your consideration, and your support as you make these important decisions for capital investment. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Paulson. Members, we have some time for questions.
Chairman, just mentioned that the handout is kind of out of date. The governor is actually recommending your three projects of $263,000.
That's correct. Yep.
Okay. So, Senators, please make that note.
Where does it say he's not?
Mr. Chairman?
Thank you, Senator.
In the, maybe I'm not overlooking it, but in the management and budget recommendation or the governor's items, I don't see the technology one. Is that in there?
Go ahead, Ms. Paulson.
Senator Stump, it is not in there. That's the bill that Senator Latz is putting forward. It includes that new $1.1 million in technology.
Yep. Any other questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I think it's Senator Wieger.
Yes. Also, could we get, I know we're focusing on the bonding part, but a part of the narrative on the outcomes of the school shows progress by students, some comparison, but you have 2006 data, and if you had that updated, it just puts it in perspective on return on investment.
Ms. Paulson.
Thank you very much, Senator Wieger, for that suggestion.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Senator Stump.
To go back to the project on the drainage one, is there more than just building damage that's being done, or is there you're part of a watershed district, so generally those projects should go through the watershed district too, so that, you know, if there's some other kinds of contributions that the watershed district wants to make through their for their outlets or for their inlets and how that drains, plus they may have technicians that do some of the work. Has that been pursued?
Ms. Paulson.
Mr. Chair, could I turn the question over to Mike Zabel?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr.
Zabel.
Chair. Senator Stump. Yes, we are searching for those opportunities with the Watershed District as well. We're looking at them to assist us in this manner. You know, we have, in order for the repairs to even make sense, we've got to control the water first, and that's what we're looking for with the storm sewer, the new line to go through underground to our holding ponds. But we're also going to be looking to the Watershed District for some assistance as well.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator
just
Stump.
I think it seems like, and I haven't actually looked at it, but it seems like the water is coming onto your land or onto the Purpich land and going off of the land. So it's actually part of a drainage system. So I would think that you'd want to have a plan in place through that watershed district too, so that the project could be implemented with an agreement on the downstream and the upstream property owners.
Mr. Zabel, any further comments?
No, other than to say we agree.
Any other questions? I do have one question, Ms. Paulson or Mr. Zabel. You'd mentioned the sign. There typically, I think most of us, when that type of event happens, there's insurance proceeds that are accessed. Have you received any insurance payment? And if you have, are you willing to reduce your request by that amount? Normally, that type of thing would have a full replacement.
Mr. Chair, yes, we have worked with the Risk Management Division within the Department of Administration. We have a claim with them. We are looking to not only replace what was there, but upgrade it and make it a little bit more nicer electronic so that we would be able to advertise performances for the neighborhood and the commuters who drive along Highway 55.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Zabel. Any final questions? Members, if not, we just have one reminder that our next Capital Investment Committee hearing is next Wednesday, 1 week from today, February 22nd at 8:30 back in this room. Next Monday, we are not meeting because it's a holiday, President's Day, so I'm sure you'll be celebrating that. Is that right?
We've never got that off before.
Get that off. We have a room.
Never got it off before.
Government. Okay.
The rest of the
if there's a change to that agenda, we'll notify you. But apparently, our committee administrator has it off. Maybe. No,
I don't know.
I'm just kidding.
These new senators think we get every day off. Oh, yeah.
Trying to create new holidays for you.
We've never had
all right, we're adjourned. Thank you.